continued to recognize the legitimacy of Nguyen rule, and in any case, Catholics never exceeded 5% of the total Vietnamese population. What transformed Catholicism into a major problem was the collision of two separate projects occurring against the backdrop of European colonial expansion into Asia. The first was the reinvigorated Catholic mission in Da Nang following the restoration of the Catholic monarchy in France in 1815 and in the context of the religiously liberal Vietnam emerging under Gia Long. The second was Minh Mang's Confucian-inspired revolution designed to eliminate heterodox threats to rule from Hue and to place Da Nang and all of its religions under the emperor's tight control. This is why trouble between Catholics and the Vietnamese court only became a divisive problem during Minh Mang's administrative revolution in the 1830s, not before. Let us focus first on how Catholicism became such a problem for Minh Mang's state-building project, and then turn to the international conjuncture in order to understand how and why the French found it a useful pretext to justify colonial conquest. While Minh Mang never hid his personal disdain for Catholicism and would go after Catholics with a vengeance, he was not necessarily singling them out for persecution, at least not at the outset. He pursued others who challenged or appeared to challenge his revolution with the same ruthlessness. This included southern warlords, Cham and Khmer anti-colonialists, and defiant peasants, as well as Vietnamese Buddhists and Muslims. In the early 1830s, he sent his troops to attack Cham Muslims who declared a jihad on the Nguyen for Minh Mang's attack on Islam and who made a last stand to save their land from Vietnamese colonization. Minh Mang crushed Buddhist-minded revolts in the Mekong Delta and did the same in Nguyen, Cambodia, all the while seeking to promote and impose a Confucian orthodoxy in the place of all of this heterodoxy. In January 1833, the emperor issued the first kingdom-wide prohibition of Catholicism. A series of subsequent edicts ordered the destruction of churches and the dispersion of congregations and required Vietnamese believers to recant or submit to royal power. Many Catholics, Europeans, and Vietnamese fled the country or headed into the highlands. Others fell into government hands. This attack on religion was an essential part of the wider administrative revolution discussed before, reaching from the Chinese border in the north to the Mekong Delta in the south. What sent Vietnamese Catholicism down a particularly dangerous path and politicized it profoundly was missionary participation in the Li Van Khoi revolt in the south between 1833 and 1835. Li Van Khoi was the adopted son of General Li Van Duyet. Opposed to Minh Mang's efforts to take control of the South following his father's death, Khoi solicited the support of various groups who also resented their increasing loss of autonomy and religious freedom. Khoi quickly found allies among the Chinese settler community, exiles from northern Vietnam, and even among disgruntled Nguyen civil servants. Catholics, both Vietnamese believers and European missionaries, joined him in the hope that he would restore the religious freedom they had enjoyed under Gia Long. They had nothing to lose, given the emperor's recent decrees and the hard-handed methods he used to enforce them. In May 1833, the southern insurrection began when Lai Van Khoi called on people to oppose Minh Mang and remember what his father, the great general Lai Van Duyet, had done. It was this time and not before a southern separatist call to arms. It also confirmed Minh Mang's worst fears. In any case, the revolt spread rapidly until all six provinces of the south, called Nam Ki under Minh Mang's 1833 administrative reform, were in rebel hands. Catholics, Muslims, Buddhists, Cham, Khmer, and Chinese joined its ranks. It took Minh Mang's imperial army over 2 years to smash the revolt and retake the citadel from the rebels holed up in Saigon. Khoi died before falling into imperial hands. However, the emperor showed no mercy toward the survivors. Of the prisoners taken in Saigon, 1,200 men and women were buried alive. Ming Mang ordered Lê Văn Duyệt's tomb in Saigon to be razed to the ground. The emperor held this family responsible for having planted the seeds of southern secession. That said, it could be argued that the emperor's inflexible methods had created a separatist problem where there had never truly been one. The emperor was, after all, born a southerner himself. Although Christians were but one group among several opposed to the emperor's policies, their participation in this revolt convinced Min Mang that Catholics were inimical to his ability to rule and had to be uprooted once and for all. The public execution of dozens of Vietnamese and European missionaries implicated in the Southern Revolt, including the gruesome one of Father Marchand, served as a warning to all that he would brook no opposition to his rule. While Minh Mang's son would temporarily moderate these policies, state-sponsored persecution of Catholics continued until the signing of a treaty with the French in 1862. This was where Minh Mang's methods intersected with both the international situation and a French domestic situation that transformed the issue of Catholics in Vietnam. Firstly, this intensive attack on Vietnamese Catholicism coincided with a renaissance of French imperial expansion, to which we will return later. Secondly, imperial persecution of Christians occurred just as French Catholicism and missionary activity in particular was undergoing something of a 19th-century renaissance. The restoration of the Bourbons to the French throne in 1815 meant the resurgence of the Catholic Church and of its missionary work, both of which had suffered during the Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars. Nowhere was this better seen than in the creation in France in 1822 of the Association de la Propagation de la Foi, Association for the Propagation of the Faith, and its prolific press, the Annales. Run initially by the Mission Étrangère de Paris, MEP, in Paris, and backed by the Vatican, this association and its magazine reported widely on the missions, their work, and needs. From the 1830s onward, the MEP and new Catholic media outlets provided readers with detailed accounts of missionary suffering at the hands of the cruel Nguyen. By the time of his death in 1841, Minh Mang was well known to French Catholics as a bloodthirsty and barbarian despot. The lurid details of the ruler's persecution of missionaries attracted a larger readership, solicited sympathy, and generated sizable financial contributions for the MEP mission operating clandestinely in Vietnam. This and the revival of French Catholicism further strengthened the MEP in Vietnam with the dispatch of a new generation of mainly French missionaries. Highly energized, these young men resumed their proselytizing with zeal. This, in turn, only confirmed Minh Mang's fears that the Catholics were a fifth column when that had not initially been the case. Lastly, Nguyen persecution of Catholics coincided with the coming to power in 1852 of Napoleon III and the beginning of the Second Empire in France. Not only was Napoleon III a Catholic monarch, but he was also set on making France a global imperial power. This boded ill for the security of Đại Nam, whose leaders failed to grasp how their continued persecution of Catholics in this rapidly changing international context could transform Vietnamese Catholicism into the pretext Napoleon III needed to attack Vietnam. The Nguyen also persecuted Muslims, but they could do this with impunity. The Ottoman Empire was in no position to intervene on their behalf in the 1850s in faraway Asia. It was Vietnam's disaster that, on the far side of the world, political and technological changes were happening that suddenly gave Catholics a powerful and determined sponsor. Internal instability and international threats. Minh Mang's successors, Thieu Tri, 1841-7, and Thieu Duc, 1847-83, did their best to hold Vietnam together following the death of their illustrious predecessor. In the face of dual internal and external threats, they increased their control over foreign affairs with the Europeans being of particular concern. The court monitored the Opium War, which allowed the British to colonize Hong Kong in 1842 and then join in an international colonial coalition in charge of treaty ports and concessions running down China's entire coast. The French obtained a concession in Shanghai in 1847. The Americans did too. In that same year, the French Navy intervened in Da Nang to free Catholic missionaries, inflicting a humiliating defeat on the Nguyen. The court reacted by limiting travel abroad for its subjects and sought to control foreign trade by confining it to specific ports and licensing Chinese merchants to serve as intermediaries. Was this the closing off of Vietnam under the Nguyen? It was not so much that the Nguyen were turning inward or isolating themselves from the outside world, as that they were trying to keep the coastal colonization of China from extending straight into Vietnam. They also wanted to control access to international contacts, ones which internal foes could use against them to reverse their father's revolution, or worse. The Nguyen must have been aware of the Chinese Qing dynasty's inability to keep precisely such international contacts and trade out of the hands of political competitors residing along the southern coast, most notably Ming loyalists, pirates, religious millenarians, and a stream of unemployed, hungry peasants. Nguyen efforts to control external contacts also had much in common with the Sakoku or locked foreign policy that the Tokugawa House had adopted in 17th century Japan to stop the Portuguese from arming the shogun's internal rivals. It may not have been suited to the international context of the 19th century, but there was a logic to what the Nguyen were doing, and, as in Japan, locked did not necessarily mean closed. More than anything else, the Nguyen wanted to monopolize contacts with the outside. This is why the state-sponsored rice trade with Singapore and southern China continued to flourish, as did commerce with Hainan, Thailand, and Cambodia. Nguyen rulers continued to purchase and adapt Western military technology and weapons to their local needs. Until the 1830s, Vietnam was home to a surprisingly modern shipbuilding industry. In 1838, the emperor purchased a Western steamship and ordered his engineers to learn how to make one. In fact, the emperor informed his subordinates of the importance of mastering modern naval warfare. "I indeed have a cursory knowledge of one or two of the tactics of the Western countries, but I want you all to examine them and become familiar with them, and make your findings and calculations into books. We will order soldiers to study them day and night." Meanwhile, the Nguyen continued to dispatch diplomatic missions abroad to report on international events, including a delegation led by the Catholic advisor Nguyen Truong Tho, a firm believer in implementing far-reaching reforms of a Western kind. Unlike the Japanese, however, Tu Tri and Tu Duc never really had enough time before the French attacked to realign reform away from its Confucian trajectory toward a capitalist-minded one. Instead, they found themselves scrambling from one crisis to another. And, like the Qing, the Nguyen not only had to deal with the outside world, but they continued to encounter challenging problems inside, not least of all deep factionalism in the court. Environmental problems also undermined the ability of the Nguyen to hold Vietnam together as the French huddled off the coast. Natural disasters, drought, hunger, and disease undermined popular support for the court at this crucial conjuncture. A massive cholera epidemic spread across the kingdom in the late 1840s, combining with famine to kill an estimated 8 to 10% of the rural population, roughly 800,000 deaths out of a total estimated population of 8 million people. Vietnam was not China, but proportionally, this environmental tragedy ranked among the deadliest ones marching across the Asian continent at that time. The court struggled to supply rice and relief to the poor, all the while taxing them in order to generate badly needed revenue. The peasants were selling their lands to rich landholders in order to survive, and land concentration in the north increased, while the potential tax base decreased. Revenues then declined as peasant unemployment took off. Unable to pay civil servants adequately, corruption spread while loyalties realigned, further weakening Wei's authority. A vicious cycle ensued. The Nguyen monarchy did its best to provide emergency relief through aid as well as through land and welfare policies. Maintaining, improving, and expanding dikes were important concerns for rulers, as was the maintenance of a network of granaries to get people through tough times. State-sponsored shelters for the poor and the elderly existed, and there was no attempt to stigmatize poverty. Non-governmental charity groups, mutual aid societies, and relief programs did their best to help the poor, filling in where the state could not. Buddhist clergy across the country did their best to alleviate the suffering. One Buddhist offshoot was particularly active in the South during the cholera epidemic of 1849, the Busong Ki Huang sect, or the Mysterious Fragrance of the Precious Mountain. However, as suffering spread, conversions to Buddhism in the Mekong Delta took off, something that only reinforced Wei's opposition to religious meddling in state affairs. Meanwhile, in an ever stronger financial position thanks to revived Catholicism in Europe and generous donations, MEP missionaries continued their own religious and charitable activities outside state control. And this, as well as increased Catholic conversions among the poor, further fed the religion problem. Ming Mang's successors responded with repression. However, the very fact that these religious groups continued to function in spite of repeated prohibitions left no doubt that the Nguyen were not in full control at the local level or able to alleviate, much less diffuse, major socio-economic problems, hunger above all. In all, some 415 revolts arose to challenge the Nguyen emperors during the first 6 decades of the 19th century. To shore up support, Tu Duc issued decrees exhorting the population to respect state-sponsored tutelary spirits and remain loyal. Between 1848 and 1883, Wei printed some 13,000 certificates, of which over 8,500 applied to villages from Quang Tri northward, but only 3,000 for southern villages. Northern loyalty to the court had clearly become a major concern. Rural unrest worsened, loyalties eroded, and new forms of accommodation had thus begun to form as the international situation changed rapidly in the 1850s and the possibility of external intervention and foreign support of local actors increased. In 1854, Cao Ba Khat led his revolt against the court in the name of a Li restoration. Other loyalists teamed up with Catholics who had already been realigning their relationships with the West as bloody Nguyen persecutions continued. Lê Văn Đuổi's overtures to the French in the early 1860s were driven by the suffering Catholics had endured since the 1830s, but driven too by a wave of peasant hunger sweeping through the countryside. Many Khmer, Cham, and Thai anti-colonialists saw the possibility of recovering their earlier independence via foreign intervention against the Nguyen. When the French attacked Vietnam as part of a renewed European assault on China during the Second Opium War, 1857-60, the Nguyen state not only remained a politically divided house, but it was also a socially exhausted one. A French colonial meridian and the implosion of Dai Nam. French colonial expansion into Asia. The French intervened in southern Vietnam in 1858 for a number of reasons. Spreading Catholicism was among the least important of them. Most importantly, colonial possessions provided national and international prestige. Napoleon III firmly believed this. Between 1852 and 1871, through an activist and interventionist foreign policy, he did everything possible to reestablish his country's grandeur at the global level. His successful participation with the British in the Crimean War, 1854-6, against Russia confirmed the return of a European-minded France, as did his meddling in Italian affairs and papal politics. Outside of Europe, Napoleon sought to build an empire capable of rivaling that of the British, but in fact he could also pursue the same goal in collaboration with the British as in the Crimean, and especially as the Second Opium War showed in Asia. He promoted the French colonial presence in Algeria, personally traveling to the colony in 1860 and again in 1865. With the United States mired in civil war during that same period, he intervened in Mexico to establish a French sphere of influence in the Americans' backyard. The campaign ended in a fiasco, but it signaled his determination to make France a global player. Secondly, the French might have lost their North American empire to the British in the Treaty of Paris in 1763 and their continental one upon Napoleon's defeat in 1815, but wider forces flowed out of the 18th and early 19th centuries, such as the industrious and industrial revolutions and the related emergence of new forms of banking, financing, and insurance. These pushed France in expansionist directions long before the Third Republic took over. Driving this new imperial meridian, as scholars of British imperialism have put it, were proactive merchants, bankers, financiers, insurers, shipbuilders, and free trade-minded theorists. These gentlemen capitalists in Britain and France pushed their governments to open global markets to European industries and finance, and to pursue increasingly aggressive colonial policies in Asia in particular. Major French banks and companies established offices in the concessions and ports their government gained during the Opium Wars. Many of the French traders, bankers, and financiers pushing Napoleon III to intervene in Vietnam were already deeply involved in China and other parts of East Asia, indeed, the world. These businessmen probably held Napoleon III's attention for longer than any French missionary telling horror stories about cruel Vietnamese rulers. No account of the French conquest of Vietnam can be fully understood without taking into account the resurgence of Atlantic imperialism in the 19th century, its connection to the coastal colonization of China, and the rise of a French meridian in the Afro-Asian world. The French were part of this great divergence that saw Western states, including Japan, push a new economic order on the rest of the world through the creation of formal and informal empires of a capitalist nature. Napoleon III did not need much convincing. The emperor fully supported the industrialization and modernization of France. Industrial expansion and financial institutions thrived under the Second Empire, whose leader sought to promote French commercial interests through foreign trade and conquest, formally and informally. He was convinced that colonies would provide much-needed markets for finished industrial products, as well as supplying primary materials at bargain prices. He was sympathetic to the emergence and needs of new French banks, insurance companies, and their global expansion. The collapse of older industries, notably Lyon's silk manufacturing in the mid-19th century, reinforced commercial pressure to penetrate the Asian market. Lyonnais capitalists were involved in what one scholar has called municipal imperialism. Unsurprisingly, naval expansion became a priority both for Napoleon III and those promoting the colonial project. Prestige, commercial, and colonial expansion depended on it. In order to trade with the Far East, however, the French needed strategic bases from which they could fuel and repair their ships, protect their commercial exchanges, and eventually attack. The French possessed Algiers in the Mediterranean and a concession in Shanghai, but they depended on British goodwill for access to China via Singapore and Hong Kong. Admiral Prosper de Chasseloup-Lubat, the minister of the Navy and colonies during the vital period between 1860 and 1867, was a vocal supporter of the colonization of southern Dainam. Saigon, or Da Nang, he continually repeated to anyone who would listen, could serve as France's Hong Kong. Moreover, he insisted to the emperor the Mekong River starting in Saigon could provide an independent water route to the Chinese El Dorado they all wanted to reach. The French ruler listened. Lastly, the general scramble for Asian colonies in the mid-19th century pushed Napoleon to act. The Second Empire's attack on Dainam in 1858 coincided with the India Act a year earlier, which formally transferred most of the Indian subcontinent from the private imperial hands of the East India Company to the British Crown. Between 1852 and 1885, the British completed their colonization of Burma, transforming it into a province of British India. To the east, the Americans sent Admiral Perry and his black ships to Japan in 1854 with an ultimatum to open the country to trade or suffer the consequences. The former enemies of the Tokugawa overthrew the shogun and created a new regime, that of the Meiji, whose leaders were determined to industrialize and colonize on a par with the West. In April 1857, Napoleon III formed a special committee on Cochin China, the European term for Nguyen Vietnam, and consulted extensively with missionaries, business leaders, and concerned ministers about possible colonial expansion into the Mekong Valley. It was in this regional and global context that French missionaries implored their Catholic emperor to intervene on their behalf. Napoleon was sensitive to what they were saying, not only because of his own Catholicism, but because their persecution would provide him with the perfect pretext for intervening in Cochin China in 1858, as it would in Lebanon in 1860 and Korea in 1866. All of this is why, whatever his reasons, Emperor Tu Duc could not have selected a year worse than 1857 to execute two Spanish missionaries. At the end of the year, having attacked Guangzhou with the British during the Second Opium War, Admiral Charles Rigaud de Genouilly received authorization to launch a punitive raid against Dainam, together with the Spanish based in their colony in the Philippines. The French attack on Vietnam was part of the wider Atlantic assault along the East Asian coastal arc, running from Shanghai to Saigon. A year later, in September 1858, de Genouilly led a joint Franco-Spanish attack on Da Nang and occupied the small port town. In early 1859, backed by the French government, the navy expanded its offensive to include Saigon. French forces occupied the town after heavy fighting before pushing into the surrounding provinces. France was now engaged in its most important colonial war of conquest since the one undertaken in Algeria, 1830-47. The French conquest of Vietnam. The imperial capital city, Hue, was on its own against the French. Qing China was no more in a position to assist its southern tributary ally than the Ottomans had been able to help their North African subjects in Algeria or hold the line against the Europeans in the Crimea. The Qing themselves were facing a combined Franco-British coastal assault during the Second Opium War, 1856-60. Moreover, the massive Taiping peasant rebellion originating from Guangzhou was threatening to bring down the entire Qing dynasty from the inside, 1850-64. To the west, the Thais refused to help the Vietnamese in Cochin China, keen not to give the Europeans a pretext to invade. The Vietnamese thus fought alone against the French in Nam Ky until 1862, when the Hue court finally signed the Treaty of Saigon, ceding to the French the three eastern provinces of southern Dainam, Gia Dinh, My Tho, and Bien Hoa. Emperor Tu Duc ordered his forces to cease fighting and reversed the policy of persecuting Catholics in all territories remaining under Hue's control. Determined to reach China, the French further expanded their hold on the Mekong Delta region when, in 1863, they established a protectorate over Cambodia and eyed up Lao territories on both sides of the Mekong. In 1867, the French then also occupied the three remaining western provinces of Nam Ky, as the French colony of Cochin China started to take shape. Tu Duc believed that he could regain his lost southern provinces through negotiations by according favorable trading rights and treaty ports to the French. The Chinese had done this. He could do the same. He sent a mission to Paris to negotiate the return of the three provinces in exchange for coastal concessions. He never recognized the French occupation of the three other provinces. The problem, a classic one, was that the emperor's advisers were divided into peaceful and warlike factions. His decision to sue for peace rather than continued war in 1862 caused widespread dissatisfaction and sapped his authority at a crucial moment in Vietnam's history. During the regional examinations held in Hue in late 1864, candidates openly opposed the court's conciliatory policy toward the French and linked that subject to the need to destroy Catholics, who they felt were on the enemy's side. This defiance was such that the emperor had to call in imperial troops to disperse his own officials. Further investigation revealed that this event was part of an attempt to start a war, wipe out the Catholics once and for all, and replace the ruler if need be. While all felt they had the best interests of the country in mind at the moment of its greatest need, divided loyalties now penetrated the highest levels of the government itself. To make matters worse, as a childless emperor, Tu Duc's untimely death in July 1883 brought long-standing and extremely divisive succession problems into the open. Tumultuous events in Europe ended the Second Empire's expansion up the Mekong. Napoleon's disastrous defeat at the hands of the Prussians in 1870 marginalized the French in Europe, reignited civil unrest in France, and gave rise to a nascent yet fractious Third Republic. In Cochin China in the 1870s, however, French Navy men remained at the helm, and they often operated independently of the divided metropolitan ruling class. Joining them were merchants and bankers. All of these men shared a desire to find a river route to reach the Chinese market. When French exploration teams headed by Francis Garnier and Dudard de Langres finally concluded that the higher reaches of the Mekong were unnavigable, they shifted their attention to the Red River region. These increasingly brash merchants and admirals took the lead in expanding their colonial interests beyond Cochin China, nudged by the financial and commercial lobbies discussed before. They had all found their place in the new French Republic as if little had changed in 1870. In 1873, Admiral Marie-Jules Dupré, governor of Cochin China, dispatched Francis Garnier to Hanoi to obtain the release from the Dai Nam authorities of a French merchant, Jean Dupuy. Keen to trade with southern China, Dupuy had tried to sail up the Red River without authorization. Garnier was sympathetic to this enterprise, and Dupré tacitly backed both of them. However, negotiations broke down as Garnier moved to seize control of Hanoi, declare the Red River open to navigation, and threaten unilaterally to impose a French protectorate over Tonkin. While Tu Duc sought to negotiate a way out of full-scale war, local Vietnamese commanders enlisted the support of Chinese irregulars of diverse ethnic origins called the Black Flags to attack Garnier's men. Hostilities therefore began without either the nascent Third Republic's leaders or even the Vietnamese emperor in Hue authorizing the attacks. The Black Flags overwhelmed Garnier's small force and killed the explorer. The Third Republic was unwilling to go any further, not least because of the real risk of war with China. The government in Paris reined in its officials on the ground. The violence in Hanoi had, however, forced Hue to recognize formally the loss of all of Cochin China, now including the three western provinces of Nam Ki, in a second treaty signed in Saigon in 1874. For the time being, French troops withdrew from the north, trade on the Red River resumed, and Dai Nam remained independent, albeit in its reduced form. French nationalist and colonialist policies became more aggressive after 1877, when the Republicans consolidated their power over the Legitimists, monarchists. At the helm of the metropolitan government was Jules Ferry, one of Republican France's most celebrated leaders. He was determined to break with France's monarchical and Catholic past in favor of replacing it with an equally ardent republic. The French were no longer subjects of a monarchy or the church, but rather citizens of a modern nation-state based on democratic institutions and the separation of church and state. As Prime Minister, 1880-81, 1883-5, he pushed through legislation establishing secular public education, supported major infrastructure programs integrating the country, and helped make Paris and the French language the center of national life. Ferry was also the Republic's most vocal colonial advocate. Pushing him, like Napoleon III earlier, was the colonial lobby of banking, financial, and insurance interests. Economic stagnation in France also led politicians and business leaders to agitate for renewed colonial expansion. The French economy experienced a long period of recession between 1873 and 1897, reaching a low point in 1884-5. Trade deficits were chronic. Protectionism was on the rise in Europe and the Americas. Colonies, many leaders concluded, or at least hoped, could provide the export markets and sources of growth that they so desperately wanted. Revealingly, in 1881, the government detached the question of the colonies from the Navy and attached it briefly to the Ministry of Commerce. In 1875, influential French financiers focused their attention on Asia by creating the Bank of Indochina, Banque de l'Indochine, also known as the BIC. This increasingly powerful institution helped underwrite the colonial development of what became French Indochina and issued its unique currency, la pièce indochinoise, until 1955. It also financed private and public investment throughout Asia, into China, and much farther still during the 20th century. The French bank Crédit Agricole is, in part, a descendant of the Bank of Indochina. The Third Republic and Jules Ferry's justifications for colonial expansion differed little from those of the Second Empire and the British: geopolitics, national prestige, and liberal economics. Ferry may have added the notion of a special Republican mission civilisatrice to underscore the noble, liberal-minded goals of Republican colonial ideology, but in practice, this differed little from the British notion of the white man's burden. Social Darwinism and a hodgepodge of 19th-century racialist theories helped French Republicans justify why the strong and the white should rule over the weak and the colored. And French Republican colonial expansion relied on the use of brute force, just like the British, the Americans, and countless others before them in world history. Ideologically, however, French Republicans used empire in ways the British did not. After the humiliating defeat of 1870, and now faced with the reality of German preeminence in continental Europe, Republicans saw in colonial expansion a way of affirming a new sense of national identity and grandeur, which they badly wanted. For nationalist leaders on the left and the right, the idea of la plus grande France, or Greater France, took on an ideological life of its own, with remarkable staying power in elite circles until the late 20th century. Although French public opinion remained overwhelmingly uninterested in colonial expansion and its wars to maintain the empire, government ministries and colonial lobbies joined forces to promote a favorable colonial ideology in France through the organization of exhibitions, art shows, travel and tourism, books, newspapers, and educational information. Meanwhile, a wide range of scientific, geographical, and medical associations became interested in the non-Western world which colonialism introduced and the laboratories, specimens, and art objects it could provide. The impact of empire on the ordinary Frenchman or woman was minimal, but its effect on officials, administrators, officers, and scholars was not. few Republican leaders expressed philosophical or moral opposition to suspending their belief in the rights of man when it came to conquering the rest of Vietnam. Ferry had already led the charge against Tunisia in 1881 and Madagascar 2 years later. Unlike his predecessors, however, Ferry was ready to risk war with China and Asia to get his way over Dinan. He got his chance when another naval officer, Henri Riviere, implicitly backed by colonial authorities in Saigon, led a small contingent to Hanoi in late 1881, ostensibly to free merchants held by Dinan authorities. In a replay of Garnier's hubris, Riviere was convinced that he could easily take control of Tonkin and thereby force Paris to follow suit. In April 1882, he occupied the Hanoi citadel. The Dinan court sent troops, black flag soldiers backed them, and, most importantly, this time China agreed to honor its tributary obligations. In mid-1882, the Qing dispatched troops to their southern border, where they occupied vital Dinan border towns such as Leng San and Son Te. Undaunted by this Chinese display of force, Riviere confidently marched on. But once again, things did not go according to plan. As Chinese troops looked on, Vietnamese and Black Flag troops routed the Frenchman's contingent. While Riviere had created yet another fiasco in Tonkin, he was right about one thing. The Third Republic was committed to colonial expansion in Asia. Upon taking over the premiership for the second time in February 1883, Ferry transformed Riviere's defeat into a heroic moment of truth, which required the French government to commit itself to achieving victory and building an Asian empire. War resumed in July through August 1883, when Admiral Amédée Courbet arrived at the head of naval forces. To force the Nguyen hand in the north, he attacked the capital of Hue and achieved a bloody victory over the Imperial Army on the beaches of Thuan An. The French writer and active naval officer Pierre Loti accompanied French troops into the heat of battle at Thuan An. He watched Le Grand Tuileries, the slaughter is how he put it, from the ship's deck. He noted the shells raining down on the adversary, walked among the Vietnamese corpses strewn across the dunes after the French victory, and interviewed French soldiers about what they had just done. Based on all of this, he wrote a very disturbing series of articles on the violence of colonial conquest, the nature of men at war on both sides, speaking of both the humanity and inhumanity on display that day. "We killed a lot. It was almost robbery." Outraged by Loti's less-than-heroic account of Republican soldiers committing war atrocities, Ferry ordered Loti to be discharged from the army. Thanks to this military success, French diplomat and leading colonial architect Jules Armand obtained from the Nguyen court their signatures on the Treaty of Hue in August 1883, which ceded Tonkin to the French as a newly created protectorate. As Armand warned the Nguyen court in the aftermath of the Battle of Thuan An, failure to conclude a treaty meant annihilation. "Now, here's a fact which is quite certain. You are at our mercy. We have the power to seize and destroy your capital and to cause you all to die of starvation. You have to choose between war and peace. We do not wish to conquer you, but you must accept our protectorate. For your people, it is a guarantee of peace and prosperity. It is also the only chance of survival for your government and your court. We give you 48 hours to accept or reject, in their entirety and without discussion, the terms which in our magnanimity we offer you. We are convinced that there is nothing in them dishonorable to you, and if carried out with sincerity on both sides, they will bring happiness to the people of Vietnam. If you reject them, you must expect the greatest evils. Imagine the most frightful things conceivable, and you will still fall short of the truth. The dynasty, its princes, and its court will have pronounced sentence on themselves. The name of Vietnam will no longer exist in history." tough talk and one battle victory was not enough to ensure Dainam's submission. The black flags stayed put in the north, allied with local Vietnamese forces refusing to lay down their arms. Most importantly, just across the border, Chinese forces remained in their positions. The Qing court still rejected the French right to remove Dainam from the Middle Kingdom's orbit. Like their mid-20th century successors, the Qing were not keen on having hostile and expansionist-minded foreigners on their southern doorstep. Hostilities resumed when Courbet attacked the border town of Son Tê, hoping to defeat local black flags and Chinese troops before Qing China could send in reinforcements. Sporadic fighting continued into 1884 as the French increased the size of their contingent. After Son Tê, the French occupied Bac Ninh. Unwilling to go any further, the Qing ultimately agreed to negotiate and signed the Tianjin Accord in May 1884. In so doing, they renounced their tributary relationship with Dainam and recognized the French protectorates in Dainam, in Annam, and Tonkin. The Chinese withdrew their troops, leaving Lang Son in Vietnamese hands. A second Treaty of Wei, called Patan Nôt, entered into effect in June 1884, allowing the French to take over the whole of Dainam. The signature of this treaty also obliged the Wei court to melt down the seal presented by the Qing to Jialong, which symbolized the tributary relations which had bound the two countries for half a century. Although connections between China and Vietnam would remain, the French had extricated Dainam from its tributary position in the East Asian order in order to link it through treaties to a new imperial nation-state directed from Paris. However, French colonial conquest was still incomplete. The reoccupation of frontier towns did not go as planned when local Chinese commanders at Bac Lê refused to budge. Rather than ironing out differences through diplomatic channels, French commanders preferred issuing ultimatums and using force. Ferry's government demanded the immediate Chinese evacuation of Tonkin and the payment of a 250 million franc indemnity to help cover the costs of conquest. Outraged by Chinese recalcitrance, the French blockaded and then attacked a number of southern Chinese ports. The Navy even moved on Taiwan. What had been until now a rather localized colonial war of conquest suddenly set off a wider regional conflict and confirmed yet again the wider context of the French conquest of Vietnam and its connections to China. This expansion led to increased political opposition in the National Assembly to Ferry's obsession over Tonkin. His adversaries ridiculed him as Ferry le Tonkinois. Events came to a crescendo on 28th of March, 1885, when Ferry received a pessimistic telegram informing the French government that the army had abandoned Lang Son and that a Chinese attack on the Delta was imminent. In reality, no such Chinese attack was in the works, nor was the temporary evacuation of Lang Son an impediment to French progress in occupying the border towns. However, news of the fall of Lang Son raised fears of a colonial Sedan, which was where the Prussians had surrounded Napoleon III and his army in 1870. What interested Ferry's opponents most was the chance to bring down the Prime Minister over Tonkin. Ferry ardently defended his colonial policy, setting out all the reasons why the Republic had to grow its empire, but in the end, it did not prevent a vote of no confidence and the fall of his government in April 1885, over a war that was already over. This is why the disappearance of Ferry's government did little to change the outcome of Franco-Chinese relations or the destiny of Dainam. Despite what they had argued against Ferry, his conservative adversaries were hardly anti-colonialists. More than anything else, the Lang Son affair had served internal political needs in France. The new government quickly achieved a favorable settlement with the Chinese. Ferry's nemesis, Georges Clemenceau, would go on to champion the Republic's colonial cause. Worried by simultaneous Japanese aggression in Korea, the Qing reaffirmed the validity of the Tianjin Accord with the French. In June 1885, a formal peace treaty ratified by the French Senate ended the Sino-French War. Dainam no longer existed as an independent state. To the west, the French also dismantled Thailand's tributary relationships with Lao states located throughout the Mekong River Valley. Although ships could not navigate the Mekong all the way into China, the British conquest of northern Burma nonetheless determined the French to secure their control over this waterway to the Chinese border. Relying on diplomacy, force, and exploratory missions, such as the one led by Auguste Pavy, the French contested and rejected Thai claims to these tributaries. In the end, however, force was necessary to remove them from Bangkok's own colonial hold. In 1893, the French dispatched gunboats up the Chao Phraya River to Bangkok, trained their cannons on the Chakri Royal Palace, and blockaded the Thai coast when the court refused to comply with an ultimatum to cede left Bank Lao territories. The Bangkok court was no more ready to go to war in 1893 than Wei had been a decade earlier. Thai King Rama V had no independent Asian allies to whom he could turn. Burma was British, Qing China was imploding, the Japanese and the Americans were determined to join the colonial club in Asia, while the British had their own designs on his kingdom. The Thai king signed a treaty in October recognizing the French colonization of what would become Laos, a collection of military territories and kingdoms. Luang Prabang, Champasak, and Vientiane, organized loosely in the form of a protectorate. In 1907, the Thais further ceded the Cambodian provinces of Sisuphon, Battambang, and Siem Reap, the home of the magnificent Angkor Wat temple complex, to the French. Rather than go to war over Thailand, the French and the British left it independent as a buffer state. By the end of the 19th century, colonial conquest in Asia had destroyed centuries-old states, reshaped internal political and social relations, destabilized populations, and reconfigured the geopolitical map of Asia. A concert of Asian nations largely centered on Imperial China vanished with the Qing Dynasty in 1911, and a new one would not truly appear until after the Second World War, as Chinese nationalists of all kinds struggled to create a nation-state on top of a centuries-old imperial empire which seemed to be falling apart like that of the Romans before it. As the Thais and Japanese rapidly moved to create independent nation-states based on the Western model, the French, Dutch, and British began building imperial ones on the vestiges of the states they had confiscated. For the French, this colonial state would be known as Indochina. Chapter 3. Altered States. Having signed the Treaty of Saigon in 1862, Emperor Tu Duc was convinced that he could negotiate the return of the three southern provinces in Dainam, which he had just ceded to the French, and thereby avoid a more destructive war. His viceroy for the south, Phan Thanh Yan, agreed and traveled to Saigon to open talks with the French along these lines. What neither saw coming was the refusal of the commander of the southern forces, Truong Dinh, to stand down. Born in 1820, Dinh was the son of an imperial army officer from central Vietnam stationed in the south. He joined the army like his father and established a military colony in the delta like so many settlers before him. He loved the land, and following the French attack in 1858, he faithfully mobilized a 6,000-strong guerrilla force to defend it. Impressed, Tu Duc put him in charge of the southern Righteous Army. Truong Dinh fought well, but when the emperor's emissary asked him to stop so that the court could negotiate the return of the lost provinces, the young officer replied that it was his duty to carry on in the name of king and country. He warned the sovereign's viceroy that negotiations would get them nowhere. As it turned out, he was right. In 1867, empty-handed, the viceroy Phan Thanh Yan committed suicide after having failed to stop the French from taking all of Cochinchina. Din had already taken his own life as enemy troops had closed in on him. Two of the Emperor's servants had failed in two different ways to stop the creation of a new colonial state in the Mekong Delta. Making French Cochin China. There was no French Cochin China before Emperor Tu Duc had signed over three of his six southern provinces to Napoleon III in 1862. Until then, these six provinces constituted the southern region of Dai Nam, known as Nam Ki since Minh Mang's administrative changes of 1833. The Portuguese had first started to popularize the term Cochin China in the early 16th century to refer to all of Li Vietnam, which was then limited to the Tonkin Delta. Starting in the 17th century, European Catholic missionaries circulating throughout the region adopted this term to describe the southern Nguyen state that had broken away from the north. In the 18th century, European missionaries, merchants, and travelers used the term Cochin China widely to describe this ever larger southern state. Christian missionaries may have been the first to connect this term to the six southern provinces created in 1833 in order to administer their own religious activities accordingly. What we do know is that the French government first began to appropriate the term politically in 1858 during the Cochin Chinese campaign. The appearance of the first official bulletin in 1862, the Bulletin Officiel de l'Expédition de Cochinchine, confirmed that Nam Ki was becoming French Cochin China along the lines laid out by Minh Mang's administrative reforms 30 years earlier. At the start, no one in the French ruling class knew where their colonial foothold in the eastern Mekong Delta would lead them. Political leaders in Paris had issued no master plan to authorities on the ground, which would trace the road from the 1862 Treaty of Saigon to the Indo-Chinese Union of 1887. In fact, metropolitan signals were often mixed, communications between Saigon and Paris poor, and oceanic and wireless telegraphy still largely non-existent. Although the Suez Canal opened in 1869, it took weeks before ships arrived in Saigon with news of the fall of the Second Empire. Even then, instructions remained vague as the Third Republic only slowly emerged. Uncertainty and contingency counted for as much as any grandiose colonial theories and geopolitical calculations in the making of French Cochin China and what later grew into French Indochina. As we know, French conquest began in the south and moved northward. The Treaty of Saigon, 1862, ceded to the French the three eastern provinces of Bien Hoa, Gia Dinh, Saigon, and My To, Dinh Tuong. The French also obtained the island of Paulo Condor, on which they built their notorious penitentiary. In 1863, Cambodia became a protectorate ruled from Saigon, essential to protecting Cochin China, promoting French influence up the Mekong, and containing Thai expansionism eastward. By 1867, military occupation had expanded French Cochin China to include the three remaining provinces of southern Dai Nam, Chau Dok, Anjiang, Ha Tien, and Vinh Long. In January 1863, the French government placed the administration of their Cochin Chinese territories in the hands of a powerful governor based in Saigon, assisted by a consultative council in charge of running what was, from 1865, officially called La Cochinchine Française. The Navy played a leading role in building and administering this still embryonic colonial entity. Until the 1870s, Navy officers monopolized the governorship and reported directly to the Ministry of Navy in colonies. Admirals dominated the consultative council and ran the interior ministry, which was in charge of the administration of both European and indigenous offices. After 30 years of Nguyen civilian rule, military men were once again in charge of an imperial project in the Mekong Delta.